weekly Krika lecture series. It's a pleasure to introduce our guest today, who is Gerald Easter, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston College and an associate at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. Gerry earned his PhD in political science from Columbia, and he specializes in the modern state, post-communist transition, and comparative political economy. He frequently teaches courses in comparative politics with a regional focus on Eastern Europe. He's the author of several articles on post-communist Russian politics, as well as the monograph Reconstructing the State, Personal Networks, and Elite Identity in Soviet Russia, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2000, and also the forthcoming book, Capital, Coercion, and Post-Communist States. The title of his talk today is The Russian State in the Time of Putin, and I'll observe that Gerry is apparently a practitioner of the very lost art of speaking without the assistance of PowerPoint. So I'm delighted to see that. It allows us in particular to open up the shades and let in some natural light. And so please join me in welcoming Gerry Easter.
Thank you very much. Not only do I not use PowerPoint, but later today I have to borrow somebody's cell phone. No, that's true. Okay, so the talk
We're using the mic for recording.
It
not
doesn't amplify. Yeah.
Do people need it? Do you want it?
Or can you speak more? Okay. The talk that I'm giving is entitled "The State, the Russian State in the Time of Putin." This is the background to it. Another thing, I do actually wear a watch. Oh, there's a clock on the wall.
Yeah, but it's off by now.
All right. But still, the minute goes around. my Russian military watch that was guaranteed to survive World War III broke for the third and final time. So I actually don't have a watch either. All right. The background for this talk that I'm giving today, it's not a presentation of research findings, although it comes at the end of a long research project. But it has two sources. One is that it does come at the end of a long research project that now is very close to being finished as a book that studied the politics of building a new tax system in Russia. So what gets developed in this talk are the themes that are developed in the conclusions of that book. But the second source is that last year, I was asked by the editor of the Post-Soviet Affairs Journal, Breslauer, to write an article on state building under Putin, or Putin's legacy of state building, to coincide with the transition in leadership last spring. And so the article that I wrote, which borrowed from the conclusions from the book, is what I'm presenting today. It came out finally this past fall. So when I first took on the task of writing an article about Putin's legacy as a state builder, I wanted to read what some of my colleagues had been writing about it as well. And when I looked at what was coming out, I saw that two trends seemed to emerge. One was that it seemed that there was an attempt to put labels that used to be used in the past to describe Russia, Russian politics, or a Russian state, that those had been revived to categorize, to classify what Putin had done. So you get terms like Putin's autocracy, post-communist Thermidor, neo-KGB state, terms like this. So there was definitely a recognition that something that occurred in the past seemed relevant to what was going on in the present. The second trend that I noticed was that this wasn't everybody, but at least among those that published in high-profile places, there was also a tendency to, it seemed, to take personal affront at what Putin had done and to blame Putin for the direction in which Russia had gone. And so my reaction to that was, well, first of all, I agreed with it. I thought that there was elements in the present that seemed familiar to me from what I knew of the Russian past. And secondly, I thought that Putin also, he was the leader that did move Russia more clearly in a direction of an authoritarian regime. So that was, so I agreed with that. But I also was struck by the way in which it seemed that Putin was being blamed and for Russia not becoming a capitalist society in the way in which we understand capitalism, or the way Russia didn't become a democracy in the way in which we understand democracy. And I thought that it was easy to blame Putin for that. It was easy to blame the man, but that we also should look at our own theoretical assumptions about what we expected to happen in Russia after the collapse of the communist regime. And that, and I was also struck by, if you're in this room listening to this talk, then you know the trends in the scholarship from the last 10, 20 years. And you would know that after the collapse of communism, especially, so history is probably more immune to it, or a bit more insulated to it, but in social science, and in particular in political science, so I'm in political science, there was, in the 90s, there was a backlash against area studies, quote unquote, and the people who practiced it had to go through a kind of a mea culpa or a sama critica for being so immersed in the culture and in the history that they couldn't see and couldn't predict, you know, the great events of 1989 and 91. And that the research agenda of the field after that time was influenced by people who were not from the area studies, but from other areas, from American politics, from and comparative politics, a set of people who had studied Southern Europe and Latin America, and then most famously the influence from the neoliberal economics, which, you know, people are aware of. And I, as I was going through what I was reading about Putin, and why it was people had these dashed hope, why their hopes had been dashed, and it seemed like Putin was to blame, it just made me question, made me think that you need not just to blame Putin, but you need to blame your own theoretical assumptions about what you expected to happen. And I just remember very clearly in the early 90s, which was when I was just coming out of graduate school with a very good dissertation on the early period of the Soviet state. So I have a personal experience with going to conferences and meetings and being confronted with the new research agenda and being told, I remember very clearly at Toronto one year where they had a social science workshop. And one year they brought in outsiders, you know, to the field who are going to begin to integrate, this cohort into social science more generally. And I just remember one of the talks started with the line that area studies is dead. Get used to it. Don't mourn over the body. It's dead. Move on, you know. So I just remembered this. I remembered having a feeling as if I had to apologize because I knew a lot about the Soviet Union. Anyways. And now I see, now it's 15 plus, almost 20 years later, and the theoretical assumptions that inform the research agenda, especially in political science, and probably economics as well, in the 1990s, how and looking at what that was, and then looking at what Russia turned out to be, made me wonder, why is it that no one is apologizing for Putin, for their theoretical assumptions? Why are we just blaming Putin? So that's the origins into the talk. Is that my water?
Yes.
Oh, good. All right. So that's how the article I wrote became both a characterization of trends of state building under Putin, as well as a critique on the assumptions that had informed some of, not all of, but at least some of, a good part of the literature, the scholarship in the 1990s and into the 2000s as well. Okay, so the focus is on the state, on the post-communist state, and particularly what happened to the Russian state during the eight-year period of the Putin presidency, eight plus. First off, a lot of you probably are aware, I don't need to develop it, but at least in the field, the scholarship of the field, the political scientists who study Russia, and where does the state fit in that in post-communist Russia, there was two phases, I would note, that other people note. It's not hard to see. There's an early phase in which the state receives very little attention. It's the period, you know, in the early, mid-90s, the period where there's a lot of enthusiasm about building a new Russia, where policymakers are people like Gaidar still, who, explicitly writes in his memoirs, it was his intent to destroy the state apparatus. But also in the scholarship of the time, and particularly the scholarship that's influenced by neoliberal economics, by comparative transitology, by American behavioralism, the state does not figure prominently in those literatures either, and therefore it played a minimal role in this early phase. It's not until the later part of the 80s and 90s when the transition begins to go awry, when the fiscal collapse of 98 occurs, that all of a sudden there's a reshifting of focus toward the state and in this case, the state as culprit that can explain why the transition went awry. So there was, in this second phase, a consensus that the state matters and that something happened with the state that helps to explain, you know, the outcomes that we're seeing. Although there wasn't consensus on exactly what that was. Some said that the state was too weak, some said it was too strong, et cetera. What I would add to that is that in the earlier literature, and even in this literature that returned focus to the state, the conceptualization of the state and state-society relations is influenced sometimes explicitly and often implicitly by what you would call a liberal conceptualization of the state. It's one that sees... in state society, it sees society as an aggregate of individuals. It sees society as autonomous from the state. It sees the state as, or at least should be, politically neutral. The state shouldn't have its own agenda. It should be a politically neutral set of institutions that deal within which private interests engage in battling over policy agendas, conflict resolution is resolved. It's the state you associate with John Locke, or the minimalist state you associate with Adam Smith, a liberal conceptualization of the state. Sometimes, again, I'd say it's explicit that the Russian state, if it's not doing that, should do that. But sometimes it's implicit as well. And for example, when it was the case by the late 90s and the early 2000s, when it became clear that the state was part of the explanation for why the Russian transition had gone and the direction that it had, the concept that if it wasn't embraced, you know, by a wide consensus, at least had the most traction and the most influence, and it still is invoked on things that are published today, was the notion of state capture. The state and its administrative, a coercive apparatus, had been captured by selfish private interests, which assume, by definition, if you capture something, you have to be autonomous from it. I think the state capture concept implicitly comes out of a liberal conceptualization of the state. By contrast, other people began to employ an alternative conceptualization, which can be called realist. I mean, that's just what it gets called academically. I'm not saying that makes it more real. Although, since I support it myself, I think it's more real. But it's just called realist, and I didn't make up that word. And it's the state that this conceptualization, its relationship to society, is very different. The state in this conceptualization is an actor unto itself. It's an actor with its own agenda. It's an actor in competition with society over who can control valued resources. It's the state you associate with Max Weber, German social science, maybe from the early 20th century. And also in political science, in the last couple of decades, there's been a focus on the state, a return to a focus on the state in general in political science. And much of that literature is influenced with this kind of realist approach, like the work of Charles Tilly, for example. So what I did was to try to create a conceptual scheme of the state that's influenced from this realist tradition, and then use it to try to explain, to try to illuminate what had happened to the Russian state, particularly during the Putin period. And I did that by contrasting, as the point of departure, I contrasted what I called a realist view of the Russian state, you know, based on Russian history, as opposed to a liberal conceptualization of the state, based on at least what the state was supposed to become during the transition. And then I drew attention to what I call power resources, four particular power resources. So one was coercion. In the realist state that you can see in Russian history, the coercive resources of the state are organized in a kind of police state. Whereas in the liberal state's conceptualization, coercion should be tamed into a rule of law state. So that's one distinction, at that level. Secondly, was economic resources or capital. In the real estate from Russian history, I said that economic resources tended to be organized as concessions. And in the liberal conceptualization of what the Russian state should do, its relation with society, economic resources should be organized in the form of private property. A third distinction was bureaucratic resources. And again, under the realist rubric, that bureaucratic resources are organized in a kind of patrimonial administrative scheme. Whereas by contrast, in the liberal conceptualization, bureaucratic resources should be organized according to that rational legal administrative scheme. And finally, the fourth set of power resources I called ideological, and made the distinction in the real estate in history that ideological resources were expressed in a way to impress upon and to create a cult of the state. Whereas in the liberal conceptual scheme, ideological resources should be channeled into a kind of civic nationalism. Kind of. So anyways, they're both ideal types, you know. But I use that in that scheme as the point of departure. So then the rest of the article was spent running through systematically those four areas of power resources and trying to highlight what is it about the Russian state under Putin and the way in which its power resources are organized, which are very familiar in Russian history, both the Soviet and in the imperial period. And then also trying to show in what way is it different as well. So the point of the article was to make this connection, to use Russian area studies and Russian history to try to illuminate what was going on in the Russian state under Putin. So that was the goal of the article. So anyways, I'll just run through it and give you the highlights from each one and then what the big conclusions were. All right, so first is coercion. And so that would be the police state. So, you know, it begins with just the definition of what a police state is. A police state is an authoritarian regime. I'm not sure it has to be, but it probably is. I think, yeah, it probably has to be. An authoritarian regime in which the police are there's a political police force that is an instrument of authoritarian rule. That buttresses that regime and does so through, familiar techniques, through surveillance, through intimidation, direct and indirect, and when the case need be, through physical intimidation. It was probably the most glaring of oversights in the first decade of scholarship on the post-communist Russian transition, that there wasn't a lot of attention paid to coercion and what happened to the coercive resources of the Soviet state in the new post-Soviet state. And even today, if you were to, you know, peruse through textbooks that are published on Russian politics that are meant for, you know, a general introduction class at the university level, you'll find chapters and chapters and pages on elections, on political parties, on legislature, and you won't find a lot of pages on the police. And it just seems that was a big oversight. All the institutional choices and institutional design that went on in the 1990s, the inability to subordinate the police to civilian political rule was the most important, but it took a long time before people noticed that. And again, even I say, if you order a textbook today that's published within the last year, almost every one of them will tell you virtually nothing about the police, but they'll tell you a lot about the committees of the Duma, which, you know, is something good to know too. But okay, so what's familiar? I mean, it's the idea that tells people in this room what's familiar about Russia is a police state is kind of silly. I mean, it goes back to Ivan's time, the Oprichniki. The collapse in the Cold War led to one of the largest demobilizations of coercive agents probably in history. And it ended up not being institutionally constrained, or very weakly institutionally constrained and legally constrained. And so the features that you associate with a police state, surveillance, the intimidation, and sometimes the use of the physical force, those were all on display under Putin. This is what Putin gets associated with more than anything else, was unleashing the coercive forces of the state for various functional and political and partisan and reasons. What's new about the police state under Putin is actually several things. One is in this period of the 1990s, it's a police bureaucracy that, if you include the civilian and the secret police, is about a million or so uniformed agents. Some of them, defect and go into private forms of coercion. There was something in the neighborhood of 12,000 private security firms organized in this period. The police are associated with some of the mafia protection rackets that people are familiar with, but a lot of them stayed in the police force as well. And in this period of the 90s, it's a very vulnerable period if you're a cop in Russia. You've been deprived of your sacred service mission. Your fellow police officers in the communist bloc are being put on trial. Funding for, just to pay your salary is meager, et cetera. So during this period, the police began to... I think really stood by. They was technically subordinated to Yeltsin, but Yeltsin's relationship with them, I think, was really kind of tentative. He didn't do anything to antagonize them. And in this period in the 90s, the police come up for themselves with a new service mission. So this is the first thing, is they came up with the concept of the economic security of the state. So it was something that has roots that go back a bit, but it was embraced by security forces in the 1990s and finally embraced in the mid-decade, and the opportunity to put it into practice came in 98 with the financial collapse. It was the idea that you can't have that national security isn't just a well-equipped military, it also needs to have a healthy economic base. And an economic base that is either unevenly developed, which is how they characterize the Soviet economic base, or an economic base in which there's extensive corruption, extensive criminal rackets, is also a weakness. And the opportunity to act on that new service mission came in 98 when the operational mandate for the security forces, for the MVD, for the FSB, for the new fiscal law enforcement agency, the tax police, were all extended by law to address what was seen to be economic crimes. A lot of activities that previously wasn't criminal became criminalized, for example. Like tax avoidance is, tax avoidance is that, area, that sketchy area near the edge of the law, but on the right side of the law. And after this point, tax avoidance became criminalized in Russia. So that was one thing, the new service mission that they adopted for themselves. The second thing, which I don't think has ever happened in Russian history, if it has, I don't know about it, that the police actually took the role of the police in the policy process. It used to be, military experience was important to be a political leader. It was only in the very late Soviet period that people with police experience were considered okay for politics, too. That would be Andropov. But that the police should actually control policy making is something that I don't think existed before in Russian history. And so that's a feature of the Russian, of the police state under Putin that I think is new. Also related to policy is the role of the police in policy implementation and enforcement, which was greatly extended especially in areas that involved revenue extraction. Well, that's just something I know about well, and I know it was greatly extended in that area. Maybe under Stalin, the police had such a role as overseeing and enforcing policy implementation. But that also, to the extent to which it exists, seems like something that's that is new for the Putin's police state, in general, for Russian history. A third thing is their role in politics. So in a police state, it's the role of the police to curb dissent, which is, of course, what the police were always good at in the Soviet period. In the post-communist period, they still curb dissent, but the police also play a more active role in partisan politics and in electoral politics, I think. So I think that aspect is something that's new as well. And the last thing for what's new about the Russian police state under Putin would be the role of the police in relation to the economy, the connection between coercion and capital, and the way in which the police officials, so I'm using a general term, and there's different, you know, types of policemen, of course, but the way in which they have a much more direct role in extracting economic resources from the economy, whether it be in the name of the state for revenue extraction purposes. So for example, under Putin, the tax administration, which had been an autonomous bureaucracy during the Yeltsin period, was formally subordinated to the Ministry of Finance under Putin. But that's the formal command chain. The informal command chain was that a close associate of Putin in the presidential administration, Viktor Ivanov, who's also, he's part of the, you know, this, the group of former St. Petersburg Chekisti, he actually was given the responsibility for naming who the head of the tax administration would be, and the head of the tax administration worked more closely with Ivanov in coordinating, policy priorities and in the management of the tax administration and picking targets to investigate, for example, than the Ministry of Finance was. So that's just an example of the way in which the police are so closely involved and more directly involved in the production of economic wealth. And so some of that goes on, in the name of the state in terms of revenue extraction, and some of it goes on in just simply diverting wealth into private pockets. It wasn't so much that that the police replaced, the taking of economic wealth that's associated with the business tycoons, the oligarchs, that system wasn't so much uprooted under Putin. Instead, the police moved in on it and became involved in it as well. So the second set of resources is economic resources. And so here I put the emphasis on the organization of economic resources under the Putin period become more clearly a kind of economic concessions. They're property or services that are owned by the state, but that are leased out, in effect, to actors, to executives, to managers to run for them. This is how I would characterize the Putin administration's renationalization of natural resources, for example, and the incident that everyone is so familiar with, the attack against the Yukos oil company, that the beneficiaries of the distribution of the most valuable resources of the old command economy in the 1990s. Try as they may under Yeltsin, and especially at the point of the economic collapse in 98, and very, very briefly under Putin, tried to consolidate or institutionalize that in the form of private property. Those actors, of course, were very much disabused of that possibility, and that it's been made more clear that these resources belong to quote-unquote all the people, but in practice that, of course, means the state, and that you can be a concessionaire, you can be a part of the economic elite, you can, if you can manage one of these large firms, if you can navigate, you know, through the global economy, satisfy the demands of the state, both public and maybe private demands of some state actors as well, if you can pull all of that off, then you have the opportunity to be very, very rich, a very influential person, but at the same time, you also, it's something you don't own, and it's something that can be taken away from you. There's not a contractual basis to this concession. I mean, a concession is when the football stadium lets somebody sell popcorn, so I have the monopoly on popcorn, but there's a contract. So they make money, there's some popcorn, whoever owns the stadium gets something too, but it's enforced by a contract. The way I would say that, trying to understand the relationship of the state to these most valuable economic resources is something similar to that, except it doesn't have the contractual underpinning. Instead, it depends more on political favor. And so I would also stress that seeing valuable economic resources as a kind of concession is also something familiar in Russian history. Maybe not the Soviet period. The command economy, I think, was not organized that way. But before the command economy, I mean, that is the Siberian settlement moved along the lines of a state concession to first the Stroganov family that cultivated lands, that had salt, that developed economic resources that enriched the Stroganov family, but then also were an important source of revenue for the Tsarist autocracy as well. Right up until the very end of the Tsarist period, its late industrialization drive and building of railroads, these economic projects were organized like concessions. And I think this is something that seems very familiar from Russian history about the way in which Russia works today. That what I would stress is different about the concessions economy under Putin is that it's not just the concessions economy, that it's an upstairs-downstairs economy, and the concessions are upstairs. You know, they're the Avtovaz auto plant. They're the big, you know, electrical thing that Chubais has. They're the, and then the natural resources. Downstairs, I think under Putin, there has been a genuine attempt to create a positive setting to cultivate small and medium business, for the service sector, for consumer goods, things like that. I'm not saying it's been successful, but I think it's my opinion that there's a genuine attempt by the Putin administration to curb state predation at the local level, to try to enable this part of the economy to flourish. I think there's a legal framework for it. There's, you know, reforms of the tax administration. There's constant reprimands of local officials that go too far. But being able to balance both, I think, is a difficult task. You know, that trying to cultivate a rule of law for small business is not so easy when up on the upstairs economy, then legal actors seem to feel such strong political pressure when they have to, act in disputes. So that is how I'd characterize the concessions economy. What I would, the last thing just before I move on, I'll talk maybe for about 10 more minutes. Does that sound right? And then,
yes.
Yeah, okay. And under Putin, which I think is similar to the Russian past, not the communist past, but to the imperial past and the medieval past, is that the economic elites that benefit from the concessions economy are not autonomous actors. That's one thing to stress. Secondly, that the line that separates the public and the private realm is very poorly defined. And it's become even more poorly defined, I think, under Putin, deliberately so. And thirdly, is that if you are a concessionaire, if you are part of the elite, you have obligations. You have obligations to the state. And I think that, those are ways in which the economic resources in post-communist Russia under Putin resemble something from the past. So the third is the bureaucratic one. So I'll do that one. Maybe I'll skip the ideological one. And then I'll have a conclusion, because that'll be maybe 10 minutes. All right. So the bureaucratic one, if there's been one enduring feature of Russian political history, patrimonialism easily could be at the top, you know, from the medieval courts to the imperial period to the Soviet period as well. You know, it's a myriad of bureaucratic structures and formal lines within which, within those formal lines, there has long been spots for informal organization and for for patrimonial, a patrimonial administrative structure. So what is a patrimonial administrative structure? Again, it's maybe easier to define by saying what it's not, because it's the counter to what would be a rational legal bureaucracy, which I'm not sure they exist anywhere. But at least in history, there's a point in history in which the early modern states of Europe all had patrimonial types of state bureaucratic apparatus. But the rise of capitalism, the rise of military revolutions forced some state leaders chose to move in the direction of a more rational structure. Russia, of course, is not one of those cases that moved in that direction. But you would distinguish it in that in a patrimonial structure, that it's a personalistic, the inner workings often personalistic, instead of following a routinized, institutionalized way of doing things secondly, promotion would be based on patronage as opposed to, you know, merit or expertise. Thirdly, in a patrimonial system, the bureaucracy is probably not well protected from political pressure. And in a rational bureaucracy, an ideal type of one anyway, at least there should be some mechanisms to protect it from that. So the bureaucratic structure that is in place when Putin comes to power, I think people know that the characterization of it, that at least the conventional wisdom of what it looked like, that I wouldn't depart from, that in the 1990s, the bureaucratic structure of the state was fragmented, it was kind of parcelized, it becomes a mosaic, it was described as kind of a neo-feudal system. And under Putin, I would argue that at least in two crucial areas, he certainly has improved it. I'm not sure if he's made it significantly more rational, but at least improved the ability of the central state to be able to issue directives and have a reasonable chance that they'll be followed up on, that there's been a re-centralization as well as an attempt to impose an institutional coherence in the area of territorial administration, in which, you know, that's an easy one, where Putin was took the sources of autonomy of Russia's regional governors away from them, the big one of being elected, you know, from below, and the other one is control over economic resources on your territory. And Putin was able to reclaim for the central state both its share of the economic resources from the territory, as well as reclaim for itself the right to appoint who the regional governor can be. And in the second area, it would be in fiscal administration, which, you know, was a big mess under Yeltsin. And I think that has worked better under Putin, which a lot of it naturally has to do with the good luck of world energy prices and a barrel of oil. But nonetheless, there's been a coherence to fiscal policy. There's been one finance minister, you know, under Putin. So I think those are areas where Putin probably should get at least some credit from the perspective of central state building. So I know that, the way in which, but what has also happened in this area under Putin, which is familiar to the past, is that Putin has resorted back to, he still has the dilemma that general secretaries had, that czars had, which is how do you try make certain that the policies and rules that are made at the top are implemented, you know, on their way down this command chain, especially, you know, in a country that goes through 11 time zones. So, and he's resorted to techniques that actually are very familiar, that I call bureaucratic parallelism, although I didn't make up that word. but there's a confidence to rely on centrally organized bureaucracies checking each other rather than checking from below, trusting legal mechanisms for checking. There's instead this fallback to bureaucratic checking and bureaucracies that are under the control of the executive side. There's also been the familiar campaigns that come out of the center against the bureaucracy and against their inefficiencies. And I was reading one of them, you know, not long ago, you know, it's from the Putin period, saying what lower levels of Russian state bureaucracy should be doing, not duplicating functions, not engaging in a lot of inefficiencies, et cetera, et cetera. And I was thinking to myself, I was a person that actually wrote a dissertation and a book on the party bureaucracy in the 1920s. And it struck me, what I was reading was almost word for word the same things that were coming out of the old journal Bolshevik. You know, later in the communist period, Patinaya Zhizin. I mean, it was just the editorial of every single issue. And so Putin, you know, clearly has those same problems. And so you get these campaigns, which against corruption, campaigns to improve public administration, campaigns for civil service reform. And I'm not so sure that they're more than just gestures, than really genuine attempts at reform. They're almost rituals. The last thing that you get under Putin, which is familiar with this system of bureaucratic parallelism, is the rise of the informal groupings, what used to be called the family circles. But here's where I would say this is the big difference with bureaucratic administration in the state under Putin than what it was maybe in the communist or the imperial period. It used to be the goal of central state leaders of the communist regime in the imperial period to limit the growth of these personalistic networks, you know, the family circles. And instead, I think the Putin administration has accepted them, embraced them, and co-opted them because it needs them because of the twist in of post-communist Russia's political regime in which they still have elections. And so there's a mutual interest between local political machines and the political machine that sits in the center. The trade-off of votes in the elections in exchange for support to remain in the positions through which flow the valuable economic resources that pass down the bureaucratic command chain. So, but I think that part about the patrimonialism, I think, is different from the past. It used to be the bane of the existence of general secretaries. Now it seems like that it's been accepted and it's part of it. So I'll skip the ideology part, okay, which just the cult of the state versus the civic nationalism. But, you know, it just makes reference to things that you're familiar with probably anyway. The way, you know, how Putin's attempt to try to legitimate the Russian state by kind of the selective use of aspects of Soviet patriotism and selective themes from the imperial past. The cult of leadership or personality has reemerged as well. So that's developed in that section. So I'll just go to the conclusion, though. I had four points in the conclusion. All right, the first is that it is the contention of my paper that there has been, throughout Russian history, the way in which power and wealth are organized at a macro-structural level has not fundamentally changed. Upon that structure, there have been significant variations. The Tsarist Russia is very, very different from communist Russia. The autocracy is very different from the partocracy. And so is Putin's regime in contemporary Russia, very different, you know, in ways in which regimes were organized in the past. But I would argue that who controls coercion and who controls wealth, it has not fundamentally changed. And that there really is something like recurring patterns of power and wealth in Russian history. I wouldn't attribute it to some invisible cultural forces, you know, that, you know, go across time and space. I think that, you know, there's more practical explanation for it that has to do with human beings and where their incentives are. But they're really... I've come to this point. I didn't, in the early 90s, I didn't necessarily believe this. But I certainly believe it now. There really are these recurrent patterns. Secondly, that, you know, Putin does matter. The president matters. The leader matters in Russian history. And so Putin deserves much of the credit / blame for the direction in which the regime has gone. But I would also stress that that being so, it would be important to place him in a context. He's part of an elite from an old regime whose formative influences are things like post-World War II KGB childhood, you know, and the appeals of Soviet patriotism in that milieu, you know, and growing up in a family that tried to... So I supposed to be a, you know, a modest family, you know, but yet tried to enhance their status by, you know, having some sort of connection to, you know, the Bolshevik regime in some way. His father was a partisan. His grandfather supposedly cooked for Bolshevik bigwigs. Anyways, so that's one. The second is his experience in the KGB, of course. I mean, can you get a bureaucracy that that more epitomizes the state in any Russian regime than the KGB? It's a and he's there during its heyday under Andropov, you know, in which it's a very high status bureaucracy. It's a bureaucracy that's very mistrustful of society, of, you know, reform socialism, this attempt at a little liberalization, a little democratization, and we'll get everyone to feel better about themselves and contribute more so to the state project. It's very suspicious of that. He's on duty in Germany when a seemingly stable regime was hesitant to use coercion and then collapsed as quickly as it did in the face of some social protests. So that's clearly the second influence. You know, it's this kind of, I'd call it the state socialist mentality that leave it to the elites know better, can decide the answers to society's problems. And the third influence is his experience in the post-communist period, first in St. Petersburg and then in the Yeltsin administration as well, where he really had first-hand experience after he came to Moscow with coercive resources, with the redistribution of economic resources, with the bureaucratic administrative command chain and territorial administration, and seeing how these resources were managed, or better put, mismanaged under Yeltsin is, I think, the third influence. He's part of a cultural milieu which is shaped by these types of influences, and that is something that needs to be accounted. It wasn't just one person, and his maniacal ways centered in that a particular direction. So that's that. And then the third thing in the conclusion is, what are the sources that maintain the particular patterns of power and wealth over time? And I would place the emphasis on what I presented is who can control power resources. And I would phrase it this way. From where does elite status derive in Russian history? And it derives from the state. There are no actors who can mobilize coercive resources, bureaucratic resources, economic resources to sufficiently enough so that the representative of the state is forced to negotiate with them over some sort of compromise, type of thing. That if you're ambitious, that if you crave, what goes with elite status and, wealth, et cetera, then your best bet is to go along. And that those who challenge that are apt to lose all. And it's my opinion that the ability of the state to prevent this alternative autonomous sources of elite status is what over time has sustained the particular pattern of power and wealth. Why is it that Khodorkovsky is the oligarch that is the target of the state? Because Khodorkovsky does things like funding opposition political parties, talking about building his own private pipeline so he can get oil out of Russia. So that he likes to talk to representatives of the international world of finance and of energy companies. All of these things are things that could potentially threaten the state's claim to them in Russia. That's why Khodorkovsky is targeted. Because Khodorkovsky is threatening to set up autonomous sources of his elite status. That's how I see that. And the last thing that I'd say, I'll just go back to where I started, is that in the end of the paper, I quote John Lydon, who maybe people don't know, but maybe he's better known as Johnny Rotten. He was the front man of the Sex Pistols, the English punk rock group, and who around 79, they did a tour of the United States that was famous for how bad it was. I think they toured the South. They toured like Holiday Inns in the South or something, you know, trying to annoy people and I don't know, whatever. And they didn't finish the tour. I think the group might have even broke up in the middle of it. But I think the last show of the tour into the second song, they were fighting amongst themselves, and the crowd was fighting amongst themselves. And finally, they just stopped the song. They stopped singing, and they walked off the stage. And people were booing. People were throwing bottles. And Johnny Rotten came back to the mic and said, "Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?" And that was it, and he walked away. I feel like I've been cheated by the intellectual agenda handed to me when post-communism collapsed. I feel like area studies and Russian history had a lot to say about the direction in which post-communist Russia has evolved. I feel like I can explain what has happened under Putin by making reference to what I know about Russian history. I can use that to illuminate what's happening today. And anyways, I know that in the early 90s, I felt like I had to apologize. Now I want someone to apologize to me. That's my talk.
Yes, Professor Herrera.
So, very interesting talk, Professor Easter. I wonder, though, what about the Yeltsin period? So the Putin story fits the Soviet, Stalin, strong hand, continuity sort of thesis. But what about the Yeltsin period? What about the state during Yeltsin? Do you see this as just a blip, a little part that doesn't fit the rest of the story, or I don't think
it's an aberration. There's periods, of course. If you read Khrushchevsky and not the APSR, you would know that Russia goes through these periods. All of a sudden, it breaks up. Everything's amok. And then it reconsolidates itself. So I think Yeltsin can, if you draw your points of reference from Russian history, I think that the Yeltsin period actually can be explained, at least, at one level. But what I would say on the Yeltsin, more specifically, I just say like two quick things. One is, what happened in Russia, there was never a consensus over what Russia should be in the 1990s. And Yeltsin spent, his time in office basically involved in one political crisis from another. And part of his strategy for fighting, his battles against Gorbachev's Soviet Union, Hasbulatov's Supreme Soviet, Zhuganov's Communist Party, had to do with bargaining away the power resources of the state to regional governors, to economic elites, who in turn supported him in his political battles. But in so doing, he never gave up the state's claim to those resources. Bargained them, in my opinion, bargained them away for his immediate political necessity. So I would say that's how I see it. I think sometimes I hear, maybe it's not articulated quite fully, But I hear a version of it, is that that Russia in the 90s was moving towards capitalism. It was moving towards democracy. It was messy, of course, but it was making progress. And that if Putin hadn't come along, then Russia could have had democratic consolidation and could have had, an economy that maybe private property was protected in. So I just don't, I don't see what was happening. I just don't see that in the 90s. I don't think you could call what was happening in the 90s democracy. I don't think you could call it capitalism. And I think that those that do are deluding themselves. McDonald?
Yeah, no, I've read the article on which the talk's based, and there are a lot of things I could ask about, but the one I'll focus on is your machine for continuity, that like a lot of other of your fellow practitioners, you find these instances in the past. It's a very interesting paradox that you get on both sides of the debate you're interested in. We'll hear allusions to use of coercion, the Opryshniki, or Peter Skoroprigensky, Prikaz, or Third Section, or KGB, and at the same time, and all sorts of arguments for continuity, but when you're looking at a mechanism for it, there's this, it's almost a reflex among, in your discipline, to say, well, it isn't cultural, right? That it's individual ascendants, what I would call the McFall fallacy, that if things had worked out, if we look at Yeltsin, if things had worked out just a bit differently, there were all these many negotiations that could have gone a different way. And yet, when you're explaining the impetus for Putin as political agent, and let's remember he's representative of a whole generation and a whole pleiad of different actors in those circles, we're given cultural explanations. We hear about the socialization into party loyalty, into patriotism. If these aren't cultural, I don't know what are. The same way that the state is not an abstract concept in Russian political thought. It's something that's always been being conceived of with very strong associations, a sense of, as you know, of mobilizational operation. It comes as a whole complex of ideas that I would say are cultural and are constructed, and seems to me is the only way that these ideas are passed down and lent meaning and valence and persuasiveness from generation to generation. To rest it all on modes of wealth acquisition and division of coercive labor is maybe inverting the causal force. While I agree with the general picture that it's the conceptual framework in which these things acquire meanings and relative weight and norms that would seem to me to be the prime mover in this picture.
Yeah.
Or would you say not?
Well, this is what I'd say. I wouldn't dismiss culture, and it wasn't my intention to do so. I dismissed invisible cultural forces, but I characterized Putin as a product of a particular bureaucratic culture. The way in which I look at the world, I put structure before culture. I see that while culture is something, and that ultimately it has a root, that it has a base, that I recognize that a cultural force can reinforce a particular arrangement, a set of relationships. I recognize that, but at the end, I would put that arrangement, first. That
so,
culture could change. I would leave it open that culture could change if the arrangement of these resources changed.
So true capitalism change would be an independent variable.
Say it again.
So
it sounded like political
real
science.
Capitalism would be an independent variable, and the culture that generates off it is contingent.
I suppose. Yeah, I'd have to.
That's
if you, yeah,
factor.
Well, you know, yeah. Well, that's how I've come around to seeing how the world works. I don't know. This thing. So it's, I don't know. Look in this country. Barack Obama's the president. There's a culture change, but I think there's some structural change that preceded it. There's like the enforcement of laws and maybe the laws changed or were enforced because attitudes changed. So, it's the ultimate question, and it's not necessarily, you know, it's just what social scientists will argue about for the next 1,000 years. I mean, there's just variations. You know, they come up in different variant forms. But in the end, I've decided on power, resources, and structure first, and culture emanates from it. Yeah.
I was fascinated by your discussion of the role of the police. But as a non-specialist on Russia, I kept wondering, all right, who are we talking about here precisely? Is it just the successors organizations of the KGB? Are we talking about a much broader group of people? Are they unified? Are they coherent? Are they controlled somehow from the center?
Yeah, in the paper I do make that distinction, and then continue to just say police. Although in a footnote I make the distinction. Actually in the paper I try to be careful. So there's the security agents, people that were formerly part of the secret police. There's the police, you know, which include, I use that as a more general term, which includes security agents from the old secret police, political police, but also include civilian police as well, which is very different, you know. The traffic cop, you know, from, you know, the KGB operative, you know. So in the paper, I try to be careful with the way I use the term, but in this talk, I was wasn't as loose about it. So it would depend on what particular thing I said at what point. Maybe I would have to then impose,
but
maybe.
Can you treat them as a more or less coherent?
No, oh yeah, the second part of your question, no. In Russia they get called the Siloviki. They're from the power ministries, they're from the people who use force for a living. But even among them, there's personalistic divisions. There's bureaucratic divisions, you know. And so who's responsible for what is part of a constant bureaucratic tug of war and trying to, you know, get a leader to expand the mandate and take a responsibility away from somebody else. So there's that, and then within that, it's also personalistic as well. At the point at which Putin's, the end of his presidency was coming to an end, the different policemen, mostly from KGB, but some come from the civilian thing as well. There was fighting among them, I think trying to position themselves for the succession and maybe to improve positions. And there was actually kind of gangland style murders involving some of the people. And I don't know. Putin and others have supposedly got together and impressed upon them the need to be able to cooperate. But no, it's not at all something coherent, a united force.
Are there rivalries then which could have political implications down the road?
In the future, yeah, I would guess.
Sort of following up on that. All right, so that, I mean, the image of a police state is in a very, a rigid kind of system where, you know, authority flows from top down, you have a police enforcing the law. But, I mean, one characteristic of Putin's Russia is a tremendous surge in corruption in government forces, including the police, the military, and so. When you think of, all right, so what do these guys actually do? Right, so they, I mean, you know, they're part of the state in some sense, in the fact that they're working, you know, they're formally affiliated with a state-based organization like the MPD or the Army, the military. But a lot of them are out sort of freelancing in order to make a buck for themselves, using their uniforms and their weapons to, you know, coercively extract rents, as the commons would put it, from, you know, the poor unsuspecting masses. And I mean, is that really a police state, or is it, you know, some kind of form of predatory state where some kind of poorly organized mass of armed. I mean, it's almost, I mean, the feudal imagery sounds to me a lot more pertinent here than the sort of modern police state type of image.
Well,
that's maybe what I'm getting. What do you?
Yeah, think? I understand that. There's well-ordered police states, maybe. I would, at least the way I define it, I don't use corruption and the predatorial behavior as a way, as something to make it less of a police state. So I guess my term maybe is just, is broader in that sense. If you, you know, if you have this more kind of professional image. The defining features of a police state that I use, you know, I just kind of list three things. So it's, to me, Russia's a police, I see Russia as a police state. I would suggest that, so, you know, we could argue a lot, so what is and what isn't a police state, and then come to a consensus probably eventually. My guess would be that in most places that either loosely or narrowly could be defined as a police state, it would be unusual not to see some sort of private enrichment as well. That's my, you know, off the top of my head.
All right, then another question.
What else would be a police state in your mind? What country?
China.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's lots of corruption in China too.
Yeah, see, I don't know a lot about China, but my impression is that
North Korea.
There's corruption.
let me rise to the challenge and say, I'm a policymaker, and so you know, you've convinced me that we shouldn't listen to the political scientists during the night, we should listen to the area specialists. And so now you know, I want to know from you, you know, Professor Easter, with your rich area expertise, you describe this very interesting situation where it seems like there's two contradictory tendencies under Putin: this re-centralization and a restoration of state power, but not a corresponding rationalization of state institutions. I mean, you mentioned there's a few modest reforms, but still the state as it exists is a very irrational, corrupt, problematic, clientelistic, with clientelistic networks. So. Do you think that this is a stable type of arrangement in the long term, or based on your analysis of the patterns in history which have generated these contradictory forces, what would you anticipate would be the future development of this monster that's been created?
Well, in my brain, I don't see it as contradictory. I think that creating a centralized, more rational framework, which I think Putin has done.
So you do think it's more rational?
I think this is where I would maybe elaborate even more on McDonald's question. I think that not the police predation part, but the pervasiveness of the corruption is a direct outcome of trying to maintain these centralized and rational bureaucratic structure as a system of administration, rather than accepting the limits and formally legally devolving to to other bodies, territorial division as well as maybe legal and extra state, non-state, you know, as well, and it's through this framework and the way in which resources are collected and then distributed that creates the opportunities at strategic points in that framework where the informal arrangements develop, where the patronage feeds off of, and where resources are diverted into the private private pockets. So that's how I would see the connection between the corruption and the centralization and the rationalization. The second thing, the first point about maybe some sort of professional ethic or limits on the police, And that's something that Russia does. I mean, you could even say it had it in the communist period. That was provided by the Communist Party. You know, provided something. The Tsar, you know, provided something. And that doesn't exist anymore. And the opportunities, as well as the justification and the lack of checks, seems to have intensified, maybe, probably under Putin.